here at the Perimeter Institute. I'll be talking about some work I've been doing recently. It's not yet finished, and therefore not yet published, with the quite a small laser pointer. With the authors written here, well, they're all physicists, so, and the work is definitely theoretical physics, but I'll try and explain it in a way that's accessible to an audience mainly of geometers. So whether I succeed or not, I don't know. All right. So I should start by just saying what the ADS-CFT correspondence is, roughly, or giving you some rough idea. So it's a very large area in theoretical physics. Many papers, thousands of papers published on this. So ADS stands for Anti de Sitter. And Anti de Sitter spacetime is basically the Lorentzian signature version of hyperbolic space. So in particular, it's an Einstein manifold where the Ricci tensor is something a negative number times the metric. And moreover, it's actually symmetric, in fact, maximally symmetric, under this special orthogonal group with split signature. So in dimension d plus 1, it's a symmetric space under SOD, 2. And that's, as I said, that's precisely the Lorentz signature version of hyperbolic space, which is probably more familiar to people in the audience. So let me explain things in terms of hyperbolic space rather than Lorentz signature. So here I present hyperbolic space as an open ball in r to the d minus 1. So I denote Euclidean space here by this e symbol. And the norm here is just the Euclidean norm. So h there is just the open ball, unit ball. But I put this metric on it here. So in particular, this conformal factor here blows up when I lie on the unit sphere. So here's Escher's picture of hyperbolic geometry there with the boundary at x equals 1, norm at x equals 1, infinitely far away. So there's hyperbolic space. It's a complete open manifold. But I can, I'm interested in compactifying that manifold. So I can compactify it naturally, of course, to the closed unit ball, h bar. And I'm going to put a metric on that where I take the hyperbolic metric here and I multiply it by a function f squared, where f is, I require it to be smooth and positive on the interior of the ball and to have a simple zero on the boundary, which is, of course, the boundary is, of course, a d-dimensional sphere. So the key point here is that there's no natural choice of f. So if I pick a different such f, I will get a different conformal class of metrics on the sphere. So this induces, in a natural way, the standard conformal structure on the sphere. Okay. So then this ADS-CFT correspondence, it's basically a conjecture, is a conjecture about quantum gravity. So quantum gravity is one of the main outstanding problems in theoretical physics is to understand what this means. So, I mean, I can't define quantum gravity for you because no one can. But the idea is that quantum gravity on this hyperbolic space should be equivalent to a quantum field theory that lives on this boundary sphere at infinity. And it's naturally a conformal field theory because I only have a conformal class of metrics on the sphere. So this is a very deep statement. It's saying basically that quantum gravity is a sort of non-local thing because I describe gravity in the interior of this ball by some kind of field theory that lives on the boundary of the ball. So that's the basic idea. So that's just something to have in mind during the talk. I won't really use that again in the talk, but that's the rough idea. So of course, CFT is conformal field theory. All right, so so what's known about this conjecture is best understood in string theory. And that's the setup I'm going to describe today. Or even more precisely, it's supergravity limits. So it's a particular type of supergravity called type 2b supergravity that I'll be talking about. So I realize probably not many people are familiar with that. So what is this type 2b supergravity I'm going to be talking about? Well, it's a form of general relativity, but in 10 dimensions. So I'm going to have a 10-dimensional manifold M and a Lorentz signature metric G, but with a very, very particular matter content. So in addition to my Lorentz signature metric, I'm going to have a bunch of other things as well. And they're all form fields, in fact. So I'm going to have a function, a real function phi, a three-form H. So omega 3 is supposed to denote the space of three forms on M, real three forms. And I also have a one-form, a three-form, and a five-form, which I call F subscript alpha, where alpha is 1, 3, and 5. And moreover, the five-form I require to be self-dual. So there's a Hodge-dual operator, which maps five forms to five forms in 10 dimensions. And I require that it's Hodge-dual to be equal to itself. So all of these things then have to satisfy some equations. So first of all, I have some what are called Bianchi identities, which are fairly trivial. So H is closed is the Bianchi identity for H. So because H is closed, I have this operator here, D minus H wedge, where the wedge is a wedge product of forms. And because H is closed, this squares to zero, this operator. And I require that the Fs are closed under this sort of modified exterior derivative, where I also wedge with H. And F is just denotes the formal sum of F1 plus F3 plus F5. So there are some Bianchi identities that you need to satisfy, which are fairly straightforward, and some Einstein equations, of course. And they're quite complicated. So this is what you have to deal with if you're a string theorist. Now, of course, I'm not expecting you to read all of these equations. Just to give you some idea of what they look like. So here's the Ricci tensor of G over on the left-hand side. That contains two derivatives of the metric, of course. And on the right-hand side, I have these various fields. So here I get the derivative of this function, di, and you see the various three-form. This is the norm of the three-form squared pointwise norm of H, and so on. And I get a sort of Poisson equation here for phi, which is sourced by some of these other fields, and so on. I mean, it doesn't really matter what these equations are. But let me point out that if I set all of these forms to zero, so phi, h, and the f, so I've just set them all equal to zero, then the last set of equations here are all completely trivial. They just say zero equals zero, and I get Ricci flat. So that's hopefully a more familiar Einstein equation. I just get a Ricci flat metric in 10 dimensions. Okay, so of course this wasn't pulled out of thin air. This, you know, 1 over 96 and so on. The theory is incredibly special. I won't have time to say in what way it's special. But I will need one important way that it's special. So, and that is that the second order system of equations that I just wrote down are actually integrability conditions for a set of first order equations. So, and they're written in terms of a spinner. So I have a 10 manifold, which I assume is spin. In even dimensions, the spinner bundle bundle of spinners is reducible into left and right-handed or positive and negative spinners. And so I have a particular section of S plus of M, which I'm going to call epsilon. So that's the spinner field on M. Here are the first order equations in terms of this spinner epsilon. So this is just the spin connection, Nabla here. And you see all of these fields again appearing. Here's the function phi. This is the one form F. And here's the five form F appearing. And it's just convenient to introduce this complex three-form combination here in terms of F3 and H. These are both three forms, and so G is a complex three-form. The conjugate here, I'm not going to explain what it is because I don't need it, but I would have to go into the spin representation in 10 dimensions, which I don't want to do. So this is some kind of conjugation operation here. Anyway, the point is that there's some first order system of equations for a spinner on this 10 manifold. And If I have a solution to this, I automatically get a solution of the second order equations. That's the statement. Oh, yes, and of course, I wouldn't have to say this to physicists, but the gammas here generate the Clifford algebra. So gamma I with I running from 1 up to 10 generate the Clifford algebra, my metric Gs. That's here. So again, note a very special case. So when I set, again, all of these forms to 0, phi, h, and the f's to 0, the second equation here just says that 0 equals 0. That's not interesting. And the first equation just says that the spinner epsilon is parallel. So it's killed by the spin connection. And it's actually fairly well known that, that if you have a parallel spinner, your manifold is automatically Ricci flat. So and what you do is you just take another derivative. When you take another derivative, of course, you get the Riemann curvature. And you can use that to show that the manifold has to be Ricci flat. OK. But I'm interested in the general set of equations, not just Ricci flat things. So here's a definition. So any solution to this first order system is called a supersymmetric supergravity solution. That's the definition. And I'll abbreviate supersymmetric by SUSY. Shorter. Okay, so that's a completely general definition. If someone says they're talking about supersymmetric or supergravity solutions, that's what they mean. Okay, so now for applications to ADS-CFT, I'm not interested in any old 10 manifold. I'm interested in 10 manifolds of a particular type, which are just a product, manifolds which are products of an anti de Sitter space. So I'm going to take five-dimensional anti de Sitter space time here. I don't have reasons to. Don't have time to explain why I'm interested in five dimensions in particular, but this is most interesting. So I take this 10 manifold M to be a product of ADS5. I'll describe the metric in a moment with a compact Riemannian 5 manifold Y with a metric G sub Y. And then the metric on M G is going to be essentially just the product metric, so it's essentially a Riemannian product of the metric on anti de Sitter spacetime with this metric on the compact Riemannian 5 manifold Y. But I also allow a conformal factor here, delta, where delta is just any real function on Y. Okay, so if you like, this is an ansatz that I could put into those equations, and that's what you do. And I'm interested in supersymmetric supergravity solutions where the metric takes this particular form. In fact, I want the SO42 invariance of the anti de Sitter space time to extend to all of the fields that I've talked about. And what that means in practice is that all of these forms are just pullbacks from Y, with the exception of the 5 form. So if you remember, the 5 form was self-dual. And because of that, it has to take this form here. So because it's self-dual, it has to be essentially the volume form on the ADS part plus the volume form on this Riemannian 5 manifold. And the Bianchi identity I talked about tells you that you just have a constant sitting here. Okay. So that's what you've got to solve. It's obviously quite quite a complicated system of equations, and the ingredients are quite complicated. But what the ADS-CFT conjecture says is very interesting. It says that every such supergravity solution you have of this type, this warped Riemannian product of ADS with a compact 5 manifold, gives rise to a conformal field theory on S4. So if you like, there's a map from solutions to these complicated equations to conformal field theories on the 4 sphere. And, well, I'm actually not going to say much about how this map works in a talk. If I had more time, I would. I'll hint, I think, the very last transparency of how this, what on earth is going on in this map from solutions to these equations to conformal field theories. All right. So I said they're complicated equations, but there are some simple solutions which are more familiar. So a special class of these supersymmetric solutions are given by taking not quite everything 0, but you take this function, the three form H and this the one form and three form parts of F to be zero, but I allow F5, hence this constant F, little f, to be non-zero. So if you simply impose that, then the first order spinner equations that I wrote down reduce to one single equation that's written here. So psi now is a spinner field on y, and zeta is a vector field, and the dot is just Clifford multiplication on the spin bundle of y. And this equation is quite well known, and it's called the killing spinner equation. So if you have a non-trivial solution to this equation, a spinner field psi satisfying this equation, you say you have a killing spinner on y. And it's fairly well known that this killing spinner equation is equivalent to this five-manifold y being what's called a Sasaki-Einstein five-manifold. So let me explain what that is. So first of all, it's an Einstein manifold. So g of y is an Einstein metric with positive Ricci curvature. It's Ricci. So this equation, if you take another derivative, implies that the Ricci tensor of g of y is four times the metric. So it's positive Ricci curvature. And you can rephrase this definition of Sasaki-Einstein that I've given here more geometrically as follows. So an equivalent definition is to say that y with metric g sub y is Sasaki-Einstein, if and only if its metric cone is both Kähler and Ricci flat. So you take y, and you take a product with a positive real line, and then you put this product metric where r you think of as a coordinate on r plus. So this really looks like a cone. So y would here be sitting at, say, r equals constant. And this the tip of the cone here is r equals 0. OK, so so the metric on y is Sasaki-Einstein if and only if this cone metric is both Kähler and Ricci flat, right? It's a Calabi-Yau metric. So in fact, this cone structure appears also naturally in the 10-dimensional geometry for general solutions, in fact. So the key point is that you could write the metric on anti-de Sitter spacetime, or hyperbolic space if you like, in what are called Poincaré coordinates. So in hyperbolic space, this would be a slicing of hyperbolic space by R4, or in fact, a Euclidean metric on R4. Okay, so you write your hyperbolic metric in this particular coordinate system, and then the 10-dimensional metric then takes this slightly different product form. I have the this is the Minkowski space metric, or if I was in Riemannian signature, this would just be the Euclidean metric on R4 in here, and I have now a six-manifold X, which precisely has this cone structure. So you can rewrite the 10-dimensional ADS warped ADS 5 times a compact 5 manifold in a slightly different way, as instead of warped product of Minkowski spacetime times a cone structure that's written here. So X, you can always write your solution in terms of an X that looks like this. That's X, which is a six-manifold. So hence, we can equivalently think of a supersymmetric ADS5 solution as a supersymmetric Minkowski solution, where this, what's usually called the internal manifold X, it's diffeomorphic to R plus times Y, has this cone metric appearing here. So it's conformal to a cone. Okay. So that's a key step for what I'll do next. So the set of authors up here, Granier, Minassian, Petrini, and Tomasiello, showed a few years ago that if you have any supersymmetric supergravity solution that takes this product form of Minkowski space times a six-manifold, then your solutions require that X is what's called a generalized Calabi-Yau manifold. And this is generalized in the sense of Hitchin. So before I go on, I'll need to summarize a bit of over the next couple of slides, a little bit about generalized geometry. So I apologize to the experts who are sitting here. So I'll take a slight detour before I come back to supergravity on generalized geometry. So the idea of generalized geometry is quite simple. Instead of looking at objects on the tangent bundle of a manifold X, you look at the tangent bundle plus the cotangent bundle. And you essentially regard sections of this as vectors. And they're called generalized vectors. In fact, you can do a little bit more. You can twist this a bit. So in general, this generalized tangent bundle is some extension of T of X by T star of X, where you need to specify a gerb or a connective structure of the gerb. I'm going to suppress this completely. So just ignore that if you don't know what that means. So I'll just stick with T plus T star of X. So there's a natural metric on T plus T star of X, which is ODD invariant, D's the dimension of D of X. So my generalized vector field V, a section of T plus T star, will be the sum of a vector field, say zeta, and a one form, say alpha. And I define the length of V, so my metric here is eta, to be just a contraction of the vector field into the one form. Okay, so that's non-degenerate, but it's obviously a split signature. And that metric is then ODD invariant. OK, so obviously the Lie bracket plays an important role in geometry. And in generalized geometry, that's replaced by something called the Courant bracket. So just as the Lie bracket will take two vector fields and give you another vector field, the Courant bracket takes two generalized vector fields, i.e. two sections of this thing, and gives you another one. So if I've got zeta plus alpha, a vector field in the one form, and chi plus beta, and a vector field in the one form, it's Courant bracket. Well, the vector field part is just the Lie bracket. So that's very simple. And the one form part is this rather complicated expression here. And I can again, I can twist this by a three form H. And this H, by the way, will be the same H that I introduced earlier. Okay, so well, it doesn't look so natural, but it's actually a completely natural object. So you have this Courant bracket hanging around. Next, I'll look at the symmetries. So you get slightly more symmetries in this geometry than you do in ordinary geometry. So in particular, if I look at SO T plus T star, well that's wedge 2 of T plus T star. And then I can decompose that as endomorphisms of T. And importantly, I get two forms here. So I get wedge 2 of T star, two forms. And then I get these are called bivectors here, wedge 2 of T. So in particular, using the two-form parts, there's an orthogonal transformation, which is called a B transform. So it takes a generalized vector field, vector in a one form, and it maps it so the vector part gets left alone. And the B transform is specified by some two-form omega, which is a section of this. And it acts in this particular way. So this map is an orthogonal transformation with respect to the ODD invariant metric I just described of T plus T star. So again, a key point in generalized geometry is that the symmetries are slightly bigger than just diffeomorphisms. So if you look at the symmetries of the Lie bracket, you just get diffeomorphisms. This Courant bracket has a slightly larger space of symmetries. So of course, you still have diffeomorphisms of X, but you get a semi-direct product with closed B transform. So the statement is that the Courant bracket is invariant under this orthogonal transformation, provided omega is a closed two-form. In fact, mathematica and also in the physics, it's not quite closed two-forms you want here. This should really be curvatures of unitary line models. But again, I'll suppress that detail. So you get a slightly bigger automorphism group in generalized geometry because of this freedom to do closed B transforms. So infinitesimally, one of these symmetries is going to be generated by a vector field that generates the diffeomorphism part, say chi, and two form omega, which will be exact, infinitesimally, it'll be d of some one form beta. And there's some notion of generalized Lie derivative, and you define this in exactly the way you define a Lie derivative, of one generalized vector field along another, and that's given by the expression here. So in particular, the vector part is just the ordinary Lie bracket. In a very similar way to usual geometry, I can introduce a notion of a complex structure, or rather an almost complex structure, curly J. So that's going to be a section of endomorphisms of T plus T star. I'm going to require it to be orthogonal with respect to the metric eta. It's an ODD invariant definite metric. And of course, square to minus 1. That's the key point. So because it squares to minus 1, if I look at the complexification, it will have some plus and minus I eigenspaces, say L and L bar. And those are maximal isotropic. So they're isotropic means that eta vanishes on L, L bar. And they're of maximal dimension. So what are some examples of this, of a generalized, almost complex structure? So this was really why I think Nigel introduced this, this whole area. So the two canonical examples are, well, first of all, you can take an almost complex structure I and generate one of these generalized almost complex structures. But moreover, you can also take a almost symplectic form omega. So I require omega to be non-degenerate, but not necessarily closed. And then this also defines generalized almost complex structure. So almost complex structures and almost symplectic structures are special cases. So then, of course, it's natural to say that J, curly J, is integrable if and only if this L is closed under the Courant bracket. So this just precisely imitates integrability of a complex structure by saying that the plus I eigenspace is closed under the Lie bracket. So it's a completely natural definition. And moreover, provided this three-form H is zero, integrability for these two cases is exactly what you expect it to be. So J1 is integrable precisely when this complex structure is integrable, and this one is integrable precisely when the symplectic form is integrable, right? It's closed, you know, a symplectic form. Okay, so the last technical piece of definitions that I need to make are the spin representation. So because I have a group SODD, there's a corresponding spin group as a double cover of that, spin DD. And it turns out that the standard spin representation for that group, which I call curly S of X, is in fact just the it's just a bundle of forms on X. So a spinner in this generalized sense is just a sum of differential forms of different degrees on X. And again, this is reducible into S plus and minus. So it's a reducible representation of the spin group. And the plus and minus correspond just to even and odd forms on X. OK, so in this language, a spinner is just a differential form of indefinite degree. Of course, I also need to tell you what the Clifford action is on one of these spinners. So a spinner is just a complex differential form of indefinite degree here. And then a Clifford action by a vector V, a generalized vector on omega, is just given by interior contraction with the vector part and then wedge product with a one form part. So it's a trivial one line exercise to show that this definition here satisfies the usual Clifford algebra definition. So again, precisely similar to ordinary complex geometry, there's a one-to-one correspondence between almost complex structures and pure spinner lines. So a pure spinner is a spinner omega, right? It's one of these complex differential forms, where the annihilator space, that is the subspace of the generalized tangent bundle which annihilates omega, so you get zero on the right-hand side here, is of maximal dimension. So I'll denote the annihilator space of omega by L subscript omega. And then you can define a corresponding almost complex structure J by just saying that the plus I eigenspace of J is this annihilator space L subscript omega. Okay, so I apologize for the definitions, but it's perhaps not familiar to many people. So finally, I'm interested in the case where I have two of these generalized almost complex structures, say J1 and J2. And we say that they're compatible if and only if two things. So first of all, they commute. And second of all, if I take minus their product, that's something I'll call a generalized metric. So because each of these squares to minus 1, g squares to plus 1, and I can project onto its plus and minus 1 eigenspaces with this projection operator. And then I require a positivity condition. So I require this indefinite signature metric eta is positive definite on C plus and negative definite on C minus. So this is a positivity condition. So the compatibility means that they commute, simple algebraic condition, plus some positivity condition. So when that holds, it turns out you can always write this metric G in ways that looks very complicated here. But on the right-hand side here, I have G sub X is just a Riemannian metric on X, and B is a two-form. So when I have this positivity condition, I get this positive definite metric G on X. And moreover, this two-form B, I can identify D of that with the three-form H. All right, so that was a lightning review of generalized geometry. So now I can go back to my supersymmetry equations, which I introduced earlier. So I mentioned these authors before. What they show was whenever you have a supersymmetric supergravity solution, which looks the form, takes this warped product form of Minkowski spacetime times a six-manifold X, turns out those spinner equations can be recast precisely in terms of two compatible generalized almost complex structures, which are now called J minus and J plus. So J minus will be an odd form, and J plus will be an even degree form. The corresponding pure spinners will be even and odd. So J minus has a corresponding pure spinner omega minus up to scale, and similarly for J plus. And then omega minus is an odd degree form, omega plus is an even degree form. So after considerable work, I mean, it's obviously quite non-trivial to take those equations and manipulate them, but you can do that, and you end up with these two equations here. So there are two equations for omega minus, which is an odd differential form, and the first equation just says that that's closed. And omega minus being closed actually implies that J minus is integrable, and then this is what Hitchin called a generalized Calabi-Yau manifold. So one of these generalized almost complex structures is always integrable, and that's the content of this first equation here. The second equation, it doesn't look too bad, but it's actually a lot more complicated than it looks, because hidden inside is the Hodge-Star operator. And the Hodge-Star depends on the metric, but if you recall, the metric was defined in a non-trivial way in terms of omega plus and omega minus. So the second equation depends on omega minus, even though you don't see it explicitly. So the first equation is basically trivial, and the second one is really highly non-linear in omega minus. And you see reappearing here this function A, which was this warp factor in the metric earlier, and you see these one-form, three-form, and five-form F5. So these two equations are completely equivalent to those spinner equations that that I wrote down earlier. So if you're still following, the function phi, which doesn't seem to appear here, is actually given by the norm of these spinners, where the norm is not so, because these are differential forms, there's obviously a natural norm on a spinner, but it's not quite the usual one. So this is called the Mackay pairing. It differs by the usual norm on differential forms by some minus signs. But that's not important. So that's where phi appears. It appears in the in the norm in this sort of modified sense of the of these two pure spinners, omega minus and omega plus. So in particular, we see the second equation. It says basically that J plus is generally not integrable. So Marco, who's probably sitting somewhere I can't see him, but he Marco Galtieri, called these things generalized Hermitian structures. So that's when you have an integrable generalized complex structure, say J minus, and a compatible metric. But the other one, J plus, is not necessarily integrable. All right, so in fact, even more precisely, we can say X equipped with omega minus is a generalized Calabi-Yau co. So that's because X isn't any old six manifold. It's a product of the real line, positive real line with Y. And moreover, there's a canonical vector field on X, which is just this homothetic vector field R d by dr. And you can show that both of these pure spinners, or differential forms, have weight 3 under that homothetic vector field. So that's what I would define as a generalized Calabi-Yau co, is an X that satisfies these conditions here. So because of this, this actually immediately implies that the generalized lead derivative of these two generalized almost complex structures, J plus and minus, vanishes. That's because J plus and J minus are defined in terms of the annihilated spaces of these, and the annihilated space is preserved under R d by dr, because it just maps. This lead derivative maps it to a multiple of itself. So it preserves the annihilated space, and therefore this generalized lead derivative preserves just both of the complex structures. So in other words, R d by dr is a generalized holomorphic vector field. Preserves the generalized complex structures. And since it preserves both, it also, of course, preserves the metric. And R d by dr is there, and therefore called generalized killing. So in general, if you have a generalized killing vector field, there's the generalized vector V, which whose lead derivative along V of the generalized metric vanishes. You can show that implies that it's that the vector part is a killing vector field, preserves the metric. And there's also this other condition involving this two-form B. All right. So this homothetic vector field on the cone is generalized holomorphic and also generalized killing. So it's probably a good time to go back to the simpler example, which is not generalized in any sense, which was the Suzaki-Einstein or Calabi-Yau case. So in that particular case, we can write omega minus, the odd degree form, is in fact just the usual holomorphic 3 form on a Calabi-Yau threefold. And omega plus is related to the Kähler form by this slightly complicated expression. There are some funny factors of R around. It's basically just the exponential of the Kähler form. So then it's very well known that for a Calabi-Yau cone, this homothetic vector field R d by dr is indeed holomorphic. Moreover, in the Calabi-Yau case, there's a vector field called the Reeve vector field, psi, which is defined as the complex structure acting on R d by dr. So I is just the complex structure on this Calabi-Yau. And psi is holomorphic as well, of course. It also turns out that it's killing and is unit length on y. So y, of course, sits at radius r equals 1 in a natural way inside this cone x. So that motivates, in the generalized case, defining what you might call a generalized Reeve vector field. So I define psi to be this generalized complex structure J minus acting on R d by dr in precisely analogous way as you do in the Suzaki-Einstein case here. So given that, so this is now in general a generalized vector, so I have both a vector part and a one-form part. So it's a fairly simple calculation now to show that if you take the lead derivative of omega minus along psi in the generalized sense, that you get something, again, proportional to omega minus. And by the same argument as before, that implies that psi is generalized holomorphic with respect to the integrable complex structure J minus. The other one is actually much harder because of this nonlinear feature that I described in that second equation. So after quite a lot of effort, you can show that the generalized Lie derivative of omega plus along psi is zero. And then these two conditions together imply that psi is actually a generalized killing vector field, and therefore its vector part is a killing vector. All right. So if there are any physicists here, the reason that one's interested in this is that the conformal field theories in four dimensions that I'm talking about always have an R symmetry, and this vector field psi is dual to that R symmetry. That's why I'm interested. All right. So let's look at these two equations in a little bit more detail. So it's a general algebraic fact that you can write a pure spinner omega in this rather general form. So omega is a differential form of mixed degree. It turns out for a pure spinner, you can always write it in this particular way. So alpha is a complex function. Theta 1 up to theta k, complex 1 forms. And little b and little omega are both real 2 forms. So it's an algebraic fact that you can always write a pure spinner in this way. And the integer k is called a type. So it's the number of these complex 1 forms in omega. So the first thing you can show is that assuming that X is not actually Calabi-Yau, so Calabi-Yau would be everywhere type 3 when you have three of these, when K is equal to 3, you've got three of these complex 1 forms. So assuming X is not identically Calabi-Yau, you can show that a dense open set, omega minus, is in fact type 1. So on a dense open set of X, you can write omega minus in this form here, where theta is a complex 1 form. So, well, this is very interesting for the ADS-CFT correspondence for the following reasons. So the locus where omega minus becomes type 3, i.e. On the measure 0 set where you can't write omega minus in this form, this is precisely the locus where a certain type of brain is supersymmetric. Obviously, I don't have time to describe what that means precisely. But you can show geometrically that that locus is actually Kähler in the induced structure. So it actually gets a Kähler structure induced on it in the usual sense. And for this ADS-CFT correspondence, we can identify this locus where omega minus jumps to type 3 with the moduli space of this conformal field. So that's why it's of interest. That's the first hint that this generalized geometry is telling you something interesting and useful about ADS-CFT. This moduli space naturally appears in that way. Okay, so that was a little bit about omega minus. Let me switch to this other pure spinner omega plus. So that one wasn't closed. It satisfied that slightly complicated equation, but I can split into real imaginary parts. And the real part is quite simple. So essentially, the real part of omega is indeed closed. And the imaginary part, d of it is essentially sourced by these form fields sitting over on the right-hand side here. So if we assume that F5, this 5 form, is non-zero, it's equivalent to this little f being non-zero, you can actually see from the second equation that omega plus is type 0. So that's simple to see, because if F5 is non-zero, that star of a 5 form in 6 dimensions is a 1 form. So I have a non-zero 1 form part on this side here. So the left-hand side would also have better have a non-zero 1 form part. And that means that omega plus had better have a non-zero scalar part, which means, of course, it's type 0. So now, physically, this means something. F5 is non-zero means that the solution has a non-zero D3 brain charge. Okay, so after some calculation using this equation, you can write omega plus in this form here. So there's some pre-factor, which is not very important. B plus is a 2 form. And omega plus is also a real 2 form. And it's omega plus which is important. So you can show that omega plus cubed is non-degenerate. So it's a volume form on X. So in other words, omega plus is an almost symplectic form. And moreover, the first equation here directly implies that this omega plus is actually closed. So what's slightly surprising is that even though the other generalized almost complex structure is not integrable, there is an integrable symplectic structure hidden in it, provided you have this non-zero D3 brain charge condition. So this is very natural physically, by the way, this condition. All right, so this was slightly surprising to us that you get that this Calabi-Yau cone is indeed always still equipped with a symplectic form. So in the Calabi-Yau case, omega plus is just the Kähler form. So omega plus is also, I have this homothetic vector field on the cone hanging around. You can check that omega plus has weight 2 under that. And that means I can write it as d of r squared times a 1 form, which is independent of r. In other words, sigma is a 1 form on y. So y sits, remember, at r equals 1, sitting inside this cone x. So omega plus being a symplectic form is precisely equivalent to sigma being a contact form, of course. So you always have a contact structure, a natural contact structure, on this compact 5 manifold Y. Moreover, you can show that the vector part of this generalized vector field psi that I introduced is, in fact, a Reeve vector field for that contact structure. So if I have a contact form, the Reeve vector field is, by definition, is the unique vector field that satisfies these two conditions here. So in contact geometry, this is the definition of the Reeve vector field. And this psi that I defined in a completely different way just happens to be the Reeve vector field for this contact structure. So all of this generalizes usual Sasakian geometry, where all of these things, in fact, hold. One difference is that in Sasakian geometry, this vector field has norm 1, whereas here it definitely doesn't have norm 1 in general. But it is nowhere zero, as you can see from the equation here. And hence, the vector part of this generalized vector psi will define a one-dimensional foliation of y. OK, so what can you do with the geometry that I told you about? There are some nice physical things which you're interested in the ADS-CFT correspondence. And it turns out they're precisely related to this contact structure that I've just described. So a key thing of interest in a conformal field theory is something called its central charge. That's a real number. And as I say here, in a conformal field theory, the central charge basically counts the number of degrees of freedom in your theory. So it's a very important quantity that you're interested in. And the supergravity formula for that central charge is given by this bizarre-looking integral here. So you integrate e to the 8 delta. Delta was a function on y, remember. And here I've got the volume form of y. It's some funny factors of pi. So a completely general thing that the conformal field theory tells you is that if this vector field generates a U1 action, i.e. all of its orbits close, this central charge should be rational. So I don't have time to explain the argument, but there's a conformal field theory argument that tells you that if you have a U1 symmetry in your conformal field theory, that the central charge has to be a rational number. So that's a prediction about this geometric quantity here. And obviously, from this formula here, it certainly doesn't look, there's no reason why it looks rational written like that. But the observations that I've just told you about allow you to prove that it is indeed rational. So the first thing you can do is rewrite this formula on the right-hand side here in terms of the contact volume. So it turns out you can write A basically in terms of the contact volume of this 5 manifold Y. And there's an integer N that's crept in. So N is this D3 brain charge that I alluded to earlier. And it's an integer by some version of Dirac quantization. So basically, there's some integral here which has to be an integer because of some kind of quantization condition. All right, but basically this A is inversely proportional to the contact volume. So that allows you to prove very straightforwardly that it's a rational number, provided your vector field generates a circle action. So let me just skip quickly through that. So if it generates a circle action, well, first of all, that circle action is locally free, because I told you the vector field didn't vanish anywhere. So I can take a quotient of y by u1, and that will be some orbifold v. And then y is the total space of a u1 orbit bundle over v. But then the contact volume is essentially just a Chern number. So the contact volume is essentially just this first Chern class of L squared integrated over V. And it's a general fact about orbifolds and orbit bundles in general that these Chern numbers are always rational. So this central charge is essentially always a Chern number, which is quite interesting. I think actually, given the time, I'll probably skip this comment. So, well, you can also rewrite this this formula for this central charge A as an integral not over y, but over the cone. And it takes this rather nice Dostermaat-Heckmann form that's written here. Maybe I'll just let you read that. So I won't say any more. So also of interest in this ADS-CFT correspondence are certain submanifolds of y, in particular three-dimensional submanifolds of this five-manifold y. And I'm interested in particular ones where the cones over these three manifolds, so I've got some three manifolds sitting in Y. I consider the cone over that. That will be a four manifold, which is a cone. And I'm interested in those cones, which are generalized complex submanifolds in the sense of Markov. And this can also be written as a generalized coloration condition. So, well, there's an awful lot suppressed here, but given one of these submanifolds, you get a corresponding operator in this conformal field theory. So there's some operator O associated with this submanifold in the conformal field theory. And one of the most interesting things about an operator is its scaling dimension under the scaling symmetry in a conformal field theory. Of course, you have a scaling symmetry. And you want to know what its eigenvalue is under the scaling. That's called the conformal dimension delta. So there's, again, a very nice formula for this delta. I mean, it's huge amounts suppressed here, obviously. But the conformal dimension is, again, given by this nice contact volume expression, where you just get the contact volume now of sigma 3 normalized by the contact volume of y. So the field theory, again, predicts that these conformal dimensions should be rational numbers, provided this vector field has orbits that all close, i.e., you get a U1 isometry. And, well, this formula, again, allows you to prove that. So the top part here is just a Chern number. So sigma 2, you can prove that psi is always tangent to sigma 3. So you can take a quotient. You'll get some orbifold sigma 2 sitting inside the orbifold V. And this top thing here is just, again, just a Chern number, which is rational. So the scaling dimensions of these operators are always just Chern numbers. So this is a new thing that would be of interest to physicists in the ADS-CFT correspondence. So, well, that's quite abstract. There are some explicit examples. So physicists are quite good at solving equations. And here's quite a complicated example. So there are not many explicit examples that are not Sakai-Einstein manifolds. But here's one. It was discovered by Filch and Warner. So this is a one of these generalized structures on ADS5 times S5. So my compact 5 manifold is S5. But the metric on S5 is not the round one. So it's given by this rather complicated looking metric here. So theta and phi are some coordinates. And the sigma i's are left invariant one forms on the manifold SU2. And well, I've not written all the expressions for these three forms, F3 and H, but they're known. And this satisfies those rather complicated equations that I wrote down earlier. Right, well, I didn't describe the localization for it, so I'll skip that comment. But let me go to the bottom here and just state that the type-changing locus of omega minus in this solution is a copy of C2 sitting inside R6. So I have an integrable generalized complex structure corresponding to omega minus, and that becomes a usual complex structure on a subspace, which is then naturally C2 sitting inside cone over S5, which is R6. And it just happens to be given by this theta equals 0. And this conformal field theory is known for this example, and its moduli space is indeed C2. All right, so let me go to some open problems and questions. So about the first may be of most interest. So because I have some symmetries, essentially generalized holomorphic vector fields and generalized killing vector fields, I can do a generalized reduction. So there's a sense in which you can generalize usual Kähler reduction or a holomorphic quotient in this generalized setting. And that was studied quite recently by this set of authors here, again, including Marco. So you can perform a generalized reduction of this cone X along this vector field psi. And what you obtain is, in general, because psi just defines a foliation, you get a transverse structure. That transverse structure is, again, generalized Hermitian. And in some sense, you should think of the equations that you get for that as generalizing Kähler-Einstein geometry and positive curvature. Because in the Sasaki-Einstein case, if I did this reduction, I would get precisely Kähler-Einstein geometry and positive curvature. In this generalized sense, I get some generalization of Kähler-Einstein geometry, which we're still in the process of working out exactly what the equations are. But this should be, from a physics point of view, it's a completely natural generalization of Kähler-Einstein geometry. So this may be of interest to people. But we're still working out the details. All right, so okay. So in the Sasaki-Einstein case, there's an alternative formula for this central charge, A, which is given by the following. So it's given by this slightly ugly formula here. There's a sum, an infinite sum, over some real numbers lambda I, and these are precisely the weights of holomorphic functions on X under R dV dr. So I have a complex manifold, which is a cone. In fact, these things in the Sasaki-Einstein case are affine algebraic varieties, which are cones. And I can look at the spectrum of weights of holomorphic functions on R dV dr. And I've called the eigenvalues, or weights, lambda I. And I can write a sum. And the central charge is given by this particular formula. So a natural question is, how does this formula at all generalize? In a generalized sense. So I'm certainly very interested in this for the physics. So can one write a similar formula for this central charge in terms of some generalized cohomology of a D-bar operator? So you can define a D-bar operator in generalized geometry just as you do in usual complex geometry. Again, in this Sasaki-Einstein case, we showed in this paper, Gorlach, Martelli, and Yao, that small eigenvalues here, so small lambdas, can sometimes obstruct the existence of these Sasaki-Einstein metrics. So these are also, by the way, obstructions to Kähler-Einstein metrics on Fano orbit folds. So they're new obstructions that we observed a couple of years ago. So again, I expect actually there to be some analog in generalized geometry, i.e., that there should be obstructions to existence of these. Whatever this generalized Kähler-Einstein geometry is up here, I would expect there to be obstructions to the existence of those things based on some kind of eigenvalues of R dV dr on some kind of generalized cohomology. It's a bit vague, but that's the best I can say. I mean, the physics is very clear. That's how it should work. Okay, I think I'll skip the first point again, since it's a little bit technical. So again, this generalization of Kähler-Einstein geometry that I've mentioned. So of course, the Fano Kähler-Einstein condition can be written as a Monge-Ampère equation, and that's how you go about proving existence when there are no obstructions. So it's again natural to ask, can this transverse generalized Hermitian equations be reduced to some kind of Monge-Ampère equation? No idea, but that would be interesting. And in the toric case, so I kind of suppressed this, but there are examples which are toric, and you might expect there to be no obstructions in the toric case. So that would certainly be interesting. So the very last comment, which is that I'd like to make, which is probably even more cryptic than anything else that I've said. So what I haven't said much about is what is this CFT that I've been alluding to. So now, in general, I've got no idea. But in the Calabi-Yau case, if your cone admits a Crepin resolution, so as I said, in the Slack-Einstein case, these are generally affine algebraic varieties. And if there's a Crepin resolution of that, say X tilde, then I can say what this CFT should be. So it's a gauge theory in four dimensions, which is described by a quiver. So a quiver is just a directed graph. And I've called the quiver here gamma. And there's a notion of something called a quiver with superpotential, W. And you can look at representations of that. So there's some category of representations of your quiver, which satisfy some relations which are given by the superpotential. So then the ADS-CFT correspondence can be restated as an equivalence of derived categories. So you have some category of representations of this quiver, and that's derived equivalent to the category of coherent sheaves on X tilde. So the answer to what is this CFT, well, it's really quite complicated. So provided you have a Crepin resolution, which you don't always have, but provided you can do that, then you want to find some kind of graph and superpotential whose derived category of representations of that is equivalent to the derived category of coherent sheaves on your Crepin resolution. If you do that, then you have this quiver directed graph gamma and superpotential. Using those two pieces of information, you can construct a quantum field theory in four dimensions. That quantum field theory is the CFT. So, I mean, if I had longer, I could explain in detail how this works. And the central charge I've been talking about, for example, has a very explicit formula in terms of this graph gamma and superpotential W. But what's interesting is to ask, well, what on earth is the generalized analog of this? And well, that's a very interesting question. But I'll stop there. Thanks. Is what, sorry? Yes, that's right, yep. Well, precisely, I've got no idea what analog of Crepin resolution I should put here. So, of course, in the complex case, it's completely well-defined. You're right, so these are Gorenstein singularities, and a Crepin resolution means that the resolution is Calabi-Yau, of course. In the generalized sense, I have no idea. So, I mean, hidden in this derived category stuff is the topological string, and that topological string in the generalized sense has not really been worked out in any detail. So I'm not sure. But I think there should be some kind of analog of this very last part. And there are examples, by the way. So the example that I mentioned, the explicit example, is indeed still described by a quiver with superpotential. So it suggests that there's still some notion of this that goes through, but I've got no idea what.
How much of this is particularly using flat
dimensions? Yeah, in different dimensions, there are similar things, but It's in any dimension, yeah. So, and if you change the dimension, then the details do change actually quite significantly. So.
One other question. In your paper about the obstruction sequences,
yeah.
You always found you had another tool that you used to get obstruction.
That's right.
So if you thought about what, because the analog of what that results in, which you use, would be just an interesting section.
That's right. So the other obstruction was related to Bishop's inequality for Einstein manifolds. It says that the volume of an Einstein positive curvature Einstein manifold, where you normalize it in a canonical way, is always bounded from above by the volume of the round sphere in the same dimension. Now, in the physics, there would indeed be, because we also understood the physics of that condition, and that still persists. So there should be some kind of geometric inequality that would work in a similar way. Yes, any pure spinner can be written in that way. Oh, is it equivalent? Yes. Yes. Oh, well, I'll ask Mark if it's on. That's a theorem in his thesis. So. Yeah, so.
Yeah.